for what they are doing. And now they actually are destroying all of Gaza. And guess who will pay for it? They will call some Arab countries or Europe or others to rebuild Gaza. Once Israel is made responsible for its atrocities, they will stop doing that. For me as a pastor, I have to say, imagine if a synagogue was attacked and 20 Jewish worshippers in a synagogue were killed by an airstrike by any country. The whole Christian world will be in uproar. Unfortunately, we don't hear the Christian community actually doing much about the atrocity happening in Gaza today.
Reverend Rahab, I wanted to ask you about your latest book, Decolonizing Palestine, which challenges the weaponization of biblical texts to support the current settler colonial state of Israel. That's how it's described. And I was wondering if you could comment on some of the most adamant supporters of the Israeli military are U.S. evangelicals, and some of the fiercest critics are progressive Jews like Jewish Voice for Peace. And if you could comment on both.
Yes, actually, in this book, I try to show that actually the current state of Israel in its occupation of the West Bank and Gaza is actually a settler colonial project. And a settler colonial project means these are settlers that they come, in this case, from Europe mainly, to settle permanently in another country, not to live with the native people, but to replace the native people and to drive them out of their own country. And to do that, they have to create a policing state, and they have to demonize the native people as savage, as terrorists, as backwards, as human animals, as we are hearing from Israeli politicians right now. And actually, if you heard Netanyahu when he said that the Israeli troops are entering Gaza that same day in October, late October, he quoted the Bible and talked about Amalek. And that is from 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 3, where God is telling Saul to go and extinct the whole Amalek community, not to spare man, woman, elderly, child, even ox and sheep. And so this is a call for genocide. And this is, again, a settler colonial tool that was done in North America, it was done in South Africa, it was done in many other countries. So what happened in the United States 400 years ago to the Native Americans is happening to Palestinians today in Gaza. So this is what I'm talking about. And this weaponizing of the Bible by Christian Zionists is something that is for us very troublesome. For us, these Christian Zionists are actually anti-Semite because they don't love the Jewish people. They want all Jews to come to Palestine, according to their ideology, that two-thirds will be killed in a war and the last third will convert to Christianity. So basically, they are calling for the annihilation of the Jewish people. But Netanyahu has no problem to share bed with them, not out of love, but to fulfill selfish desires, so to say. And I'm so glad that actually Netanyahu doesn't represent the whole Jewish people. Judaism is very broad, like Christianity and Islam. It's a very broad religion. You have from the far right to the far left. And for me, groups like Jewish Voices for Peace, Not in My Names, and many other groups that I'm in contact with them, they are a sign of hope that actually, together, as Jews, Muslims, and Christians, who are interested in equality, in human dignity, in justice, so that both peoples can share the land, and the three religions can live side by side. I think this is the vision that we are calling for.
Reverend Mitri Rahab, we want to thank you for being with us. Reverend Mitri Rahab is the president of Dar al-Kalima University in Bethlehem, Palestinian Christian theologian who's authored many books, including Decolonizing Palestine, the Land, the People, the Bible. Coming up, the United Nations Security Council is preparing possibly to vote on a watered-down resolution on aid to Gaza after the U.S. repeatedly pushed for delays, even though the U.N. is warning more than 500,000 Palestinians, about a quarter of the population, face catastrophic hunger and starvation. Back in 20 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations Security Council is preparing to vote on a watered-down resolution on aid to Gaza after the United States pushed for the vote to be delayed four times this week as Israel continued its massive assault on Gaza that's killed, at this point, over 20,000 Palestinians, reaching about the death of 1% of the Gazan population. Health officials in Gaza say at least 390 Palestinians have been killed over the last 48 hours. The United Nations is warning more than 500,000 Palestinians in Gaza, about a quarter of the population, face catastrophic hunger and starvation. We go now to Ahmed Aboufoul. He is a Gaza-born attorney who works as a legal research and advocacy officer at Al-Haq, the oldest Palestinian human rights organization. He recently wrote an article headlined, "We are witnessing a genocide unfolding in Gaza. To stop it, the ICC prosecutor must apply the law without fear or favor." Ahmed is joining us from New York City. We welcome you to Democracy Now! When you use the term genocide, you're an international human rights lawyer. Explain exactly what you mean and why you believe this applies to Gaza, Ahmed Aboufoul.
Thank you for having me, first of all. Second of all, the word genocide is a legal term that is specifically defined in international law, and it's also a crime that has elements. Once these elements are met, the crime is committed. And as you know, this is a term that has not been used a lot before in the context of Palestine, although the crime, we believe, it has been committed. So, for example, it happened in 1948. Many would argue, and I agree, was an act of genocide. The only reason we didn't call it genocide then, that we didn't have the concept of genocide had crystallized yet. We didn't have the genocide convention. We didn't have the definition. It was also used in the context of Palestine in the Sabra and Shatila massacre. And this is the only time that the UN described the situation as genocide. Genocide in international law is a crime, and it's defined when there is certain underlying acts are being committed with the special intent to destroy in whole or in part a certain ethnic or religious or political group. And in this case, we believe the situation in Gaza is that of genocide. Usually in genocide, the hardest thing to prove is the mental element and the special intent to commit genocide. And in order to prove that, courts usually recourse to statements of the perpetrators. In this particular situation, we have numerous statements of genocidal intent that are also being translated into actions on the ground. We see the level of destruction, the disregard of human life, the, in the words of Biden, the indiscriminate bombing of civilians. And this is not only our conclusion as Palestinian human rights organizations. As a matter of fact, 800 genocide and Holocaust scholars have also described the situation as genocide. And certain scholars describe it as a textbook case of genocide.
Now, Ahmed Abu-Ful, if you can talk personally about Gaza, about your homeland. You grew up in Gaza or were born in Gaza. In fact, your name, Ahmed Abu-Ful, didn't someone in your family by that same name just die?
Well, now over 60 of my family have died, including my have been killed, to be accurate, including my eldest uncle, some of my cousins. And like most Palestinians, we don't feel like we even have the luxury to grieve. I'm considering the level of destruction and the horrific crimes that are being committed. It's really heartbreaking. We've always grew up to hear the stories of the Nakba. We've never imagined that we would live it. It happened in 1948 because it wasn't televised. The world didn't know what's going on in Palestine. But now it's quite disgraceful that it's a televised carnage, and the world is literally watching. You mentioned the Security Council resolution that was watered down and will be voted on today. But if you look at this situation and if you look at the voting record, it's basically the U.S. versus the world. The U.S. is actually promoting this genocide, supporting this genocide. I would never know, and most probably my family was killed by American weapons. Our children are being torn apart on TV, on your TV screens, by American tax money, by the support of the American government. The American government is complicit in this genocide. There is blood of Palestinian children on their hands. And that's why with our partners in the U.S., with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I know you interviewed Katie Gallagher, who spoke more about this, but we're suing Biden and President Biden, but also Secretary of State Blinken and Secretary of Defense Austin, not only for their complicity in genocide, but also for the failure to prevent genocide. If there's any country in the world that can influence Israeli policies, is the U.S. And if you allow me, I mentioned that I come from a refugee family, so I'm not originally from Gaza. Like over 75% of the population in Gaza are refugees. So when we say this is a second Nakba, it is a second Nakba. In 1948, over 80% of the Palestinian population were forcibly displaced. Now we have over 90% of the population that is displaced. We have over 60% of Gaza's residential units have been destroyed. Most of the population are on the edge of starvation. It's quite shameful, to be honest, that until this very moment, the U.S. cannot do the bare minimum of human decency, which is calling for a ceasefire and trying to provide diplomatic coverage for the genocide that is unfolding in Gaza.
So can you account for, on the one hand, you have President Biden warning Israel about indiscriminate bombing, and on the other hand, you have the U.S. dragging its feet all week. Yesterday, we thought right after the show, I think 10 a.m., they were going to be voting. But now it is Friday. Four times this vote has been delayed, a resolution that will clearly not be for a ceasefire. Can you explain the significance of what difference does a U.N. Security Council resolution even make? Is it binding? What would it mean? And what it has been watered down to at this point today?
Of course. Well, the Security Council resolutions are binding, although Israel has a history of not respecting those resolutions. The U.S. has been trying to water down the language, not to include clear call for an immediate ceasefire. In the same time, they call for safe and unhindered humanitarian supplies and humanitarian aid, but at the same time, they don't call for a ceasefire. And quite strange formula from the U.S. on the one hand to want safe and unhindered humanitarian access, but without stopping the fire. So basically, it wants humanitarian aid workers to work under the hell that Israel unleashed on the Palestinian civilian population. And as you mentioned, Biden didn't only warn the Israelis, he actually made a determination, and we agree with him. He said Israel is engaged in indiscriminate bombing. This is a war crime. So the question is, why do you then send weapons to Israel? The position of the U.S. is quite hypocritical, and the U.S. cannot claim leadership in the world because it's not showing us that leadership. Actions speak louder than words. The U.S. or President Biden only yesterday tweeted that the U.S. supports the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination. 2 days before that, the U.S. voted against a resolution on the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination. So we don't want to see words. We want to see actions. And the hypocrisy of the U.S. is quite flagrant. You know, a principled leadership and true leadership is about the consistent application of international law, the principled application of international law on your foes and your allies alike. Hypocrisy, double standards, and selectivity don't reflect characteristics of leadership, but of complicity in genocide. And if you allow me, what's at stake at the moment is not only the dehumanization of the Palestinian people and the genocide that they're facing, but also the whole body of international law is being put to test. Because basically, we saw how the West, and led by the U.S., mobilized this body of international law in the case of Ukraine. But in the case of Gaza, they're preventing or failing to do the bare minimum, which is called for a ceasefire. So I think what's also at stake is the credibility and the reputation of the U.S., which always portrays itself as a beacon of democracy. But in fact, it's showing us that it supports genocide. And what's also, I think, interesting in this situation, that it's also putting all of these quote-unquote liberal democracies to test, because all polls shows that most Americans want the ceasefire, most Democrats in Congress want the ceasefire, but there seems to be a disconnect between what the people want and what the U.S. leadership is doing. So we call in on Biden and the Biden administration to listen to their people. To listen to their people and do the bare minimum, which is calling for a ceasefire.
Ahmed, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and also our condolences on the death of so many members of your family in Gaza. Ahmed Abu Ful is legal research and advocacy officer at the Palestinian human rights group AHAQ. We'll link to your piece. We're witnessing a genocide unfolding in Gaza. To stop it, the ICC prosecutor must apply the law without fear or favor. Coming up, we speak to Brazil's first ever Minister of Indigenous Peoples, back in 20 seconds.
Come, Bolivian workers, you toil night and day, by hand and by brain, to earn your pay, who for centuries long past, for no more than your bread, have bled for your countries and counted your dead in the factories and mills.
In the worker song here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with Sonia Guajajara, Brazil's first indigenous cabinet minister, country's first ever minister of indigenous peoples, took office a year ago to serve President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's administration. I spoke to her in Dubai at the UN Climate Summit and asked her to talk about the issues facing Brazil following the presidency of the far-right President Jair Bolsonaro, who led Brazil from 2019 to 2022.
We're in a moment of transition, going back to democracy in Brazil, rebuilding the rights that were taken away from us in these past few years, and strengthening actions and spaces for the participation of civil society in the federal government. And so now we need to rebuild and strengthen public policies in health, education, fighting racism, and environmental racism, and being able to have more specific measures to reduce the emissions that are causing these changes.
Can you talk about what President Lula is doing right now when it comes to indigenous people's rights, when it comes to extractive industries, restoring the Amazon rainforest, ending deforestation in the Amazon by 2030?
President Lula criou o Ministério dos Povos Indígenas.
President Lula created the Ministry of Indigenous Peoples for the first time in 55 years. Our National Foundation of Indigenous Peoples has an Indigenous president. We're also running the Indigenous Peoples' health services. This year's concrete actions were the removal of the invaders from the Yanomami territories, which significantly reduced deforestation in that territory. We also managed to get the illegal cattle ranchers out of the Apiterewa territory and of the Paracana people in the state of Pará. We've only 11 indigenous people demarcated in 10 years, and now 8 indigenous lands have been recognized. So we're in the process of advancing with protection of indigenous peoples' rights and protecting these territories, which is important for reducing deforestation and achieving zero deforestation in the Amazon by 2030.
Can you talk about the significance of the United States as historically the largest emitter of greenhouse gases? What difference it makes, U.S. policy, to the people of Brazil, to the indigenous people of Brazil? What would you like to most see the United States do or change?
Estados Unidos precisa assumir mais.
The United States needs to have more ambitious goals here in the climate discussions and also support those countries that need financial support to protect their forests, to protect their indigenous peoples and their traditional communities. It is necessary that the wealthiest countries, which emit the most, should help those countries that don't have sufficient resources to pay the bill in order to adopt specific concrete measures.
Minister Guajajara, how does it change things in Brazil to have your voice, the voice of indigenous people, for the first time ever, included, represented in the Brazilian government?
Olha, aqui na conferência do clima.
Here at the climate conference, it's the first time that there is an indigenous minister. It is unprecedented. It is also the first time that an indigenous person headed up the Brazilian delegation. So I feel very honored to represent Minister Marina Silva here for these 5 days as head of the Brazilian delegation, speaking directly with the negotiators and participating directly in high-level discussions, playing a proactive role and bringing the voice, which is not only the voice of the indigenous peoples of Brazil, but the voice of the indigenous peoples worldwide. There are many indigenous peoples here, and it's been recognized that it's very important to have a ministry, to have a woman minister participating in this forum, making decisions. For us, this is historic.
Can you talk about where you were born, where you grew up?
I was born in Arariboia, an indigenous territory in the state of Maranhão in the Brazilian Amazon. It has several different Amazonian biomes, including the Cerrado. The Amazon is also coastal. When I was born, there were still many forests, and today one can notice the drastic change. We've lost more than 60% of our native plants in the forest. So climate change is not just a problem of the future. We're experiencing the consequences right now. And that is why we must proceed down this road by occupying these spaces, such as the ministry, and also stepping up commitments and accomplishment of goals.
And can you also talk about what you're wearing? Now, normally, I don't ask a woman that question, but your headdress is so magnificent. Talk about the feathers, both on your head and also that are draped over your shoulders and your earrings.
É, nós temos ainda, né, como usar.
We continue to use our traditional clothing and other items, but we are at risk of not being able to use the accessories that mark our identities because of the climate crisis. We bring along our symbols of the people we bond to, and this also reflects how we live harmoniously with nature and how we use what is available to us. So we live with the forest, the animals, and the water, and we get from that everything we need, whether it's protected water to drink, food to eat, or the clothing we wear.
Can you talk about violence against indigenous environmental defenders. It's not only an issue in Brazil, but all over the world. The number of environmentalists, like in Honduras, Berta Cáceres, who are being murdered. How is President Lula dealing with this? How does this need to be dealt with?
Nós saímos aí de 4 anos que houve incentivo muito grande.
We have just emerged from 4 years in which there was a major incentive for attacking indigenous peoples, invading their territories. There was an increase in violence that was quite considerable in these past few years. But now we're working with President Lula to fight that violence, together with the Ministry of Human Rights, together with the Ministry for Racial Equality, and the Ministry of the Environment, because those attacks stem from land conflicts, invasion of territories, illegal logging, illegal prospecting. These are actions that we're now carrying out in a coordinated fashion with other ministries, the Ministry of Justice, with the Federal Police, with the Environmental Institute, Indigenous Affairs Institute, all working together to end violence in the territories and in the frontier areas.
What is your message to indigenous peoples around the world, and what do you want to see come out of this UN climate summit?
Para os povos indígenas, a gente...
For the indigenous peoples, we need to prepare for the road that we need to head down in order to reach COP30, which is going to be held in Belém in the Brazilian Amazon. We also need to prepare so that we can have a direct impact on the debates that unfold here at the COP. And oftentimes, we are not even close to it. It's very important that we indigenous peoples participate in these forums. And there's a group that is directly on top of this. So we are here so that indigenous peoples can have more space in decision making. And the general message is that we have little time left. The big leaders, government leaders, need not only to take on commitments here, but also to understand that we are in a state of emergency. In order to emerge from that state of emergency, investment is needed, financing is needed, and protection so that we can all protect the planet.
President Lula still has plans to do massive offshore oil drilling. As the first indigenous people's minister, do you condemn this move? Are you weighing in on this? Do you support this?
Olha, no Brasil nós estamos num momento de transição.
Look, in Brazil, we're at a moment of transition to clean energies as well. We're building that together. President Lula is committed to making that transition. And now we're using what is available to us, such as the wind and the water, so that we can emerge from the energy we're using today based on destruction, and so that we can have renewable energy that protects the peoples and that does not destroy the environment.
Last question. Earlier this year, Ecuador voted to ban oil drilling in protected Amazon lands. Will you be pushing for Brazil to take similar steps?
We're involved in that right now. President Lula is aware that we need to go forward with this transition, and together with the Ministry of Environment, we're working to act together and more quickly so that the transition can take place. We urgently need renewable energy. Only with such a change will it be possible for us to overcome the emergency situation we find ourselves in today.
That was Sonia Guajajara, Brazil's first indigenous cabinet minister, the country's first ever minister of indigenous peoples. I spoke to her in Dubai at the UN Climate Summit. On December 14th, Brazilian lawmakers overrode a veto by President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in a move that could threaten land rights for indigenous people. The issue will be taken up by Brazil's Supreme Court. To see our full interview with her, a web exclusive at democracynow.org, go there. And that does it for our show. Tune in Monday for a Democracy Now! Special, a tribute to blacklisted lyricist Yip Harburg, the man who put the rainbow in The Wizard of Oz. I'm Amy Goodman. This is another edition of Democracy Now! Happy holidays.
The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you a safe and Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Trolling college music so you don't have to. No loyalties, no orthodoxy. Keeping it real, dumb, and organic since 2019. Tune into Home of Burnaby Rock with John on Fridays from 6 to 8 p.m.
CJSF 90.1 FM wishes you a bright winter solstice.
Radio Rewind.